All right. Thank you all. Welcome to the House Education Policy Committee. I call this meeting to order. And our first order of business today is approving the minutes from Wednesday, March 1st. And Representative Feist, have you had a moment to look at the minutes? And would you please move the minutes from March 1st? And they're in the packet with the other ones.
My name?
Yes, I do. Representative Feist, thank you. Would you be able to move the minutes for us?
I would love to move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Feist. All right, Representative Feist moves the minutes from Wednesday, March 1st. And you will see that. Yes, and we have called the meeting to order today. And if we can keep our conversations down. Thank you. Apparently, we're a little distracted on this Tuesday afternoon. Thank you. All right, well, we have the minutes from March 1st moved. Any discussion from the minutes of March 1st? And that was quite the meeting. We have the combined meeting minutes from our different sessions that day. Hearing none, all in favor of the minutes of March 1st as presented, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, we have the minutes. Thank you. The motion prevails. All right, so today we do have our DE amendment to House File 1269, which would be our education policy bill moving forward at this point in our process. And so members of, you know, a couple points of understanding about this is that we are going to have nonpartisan walk through the DE amendment, and that will be the main focus of today's session. Essentially, though, this is an informational session. We're going to present it today, put it out there for the public. We're going to get feedback on it on Wednesday, and we are getting testifiers signed up for that now. We've had them signed up for that. Look forward to that discussion. And then we will have amendments introduced by Thursday. And then on Friday, we have a special meeting day set aside for discussing the amendments. So today we will have time for just a walkthrough, understanding what's in the bill right now, hoping to have member discussions and certainly questions about things. And so we're going to give time for this meeting to have that opening discussion, and then, of course, time again on Friday for amendments and discussion. And then Tuesday will be devoted to comments on it. All right, and with that, I am going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Hill.
All right, and we'll give Chair Pryor a moment to get settled. But members, because we will not be taking any legislative action on the bill, I'll just turn it over here in a moment to Chair Pryor. I, too, want to offer my message of thanks to the nonpartisan staff for all the minutes and hours and the great deal of effort that went into compiling this bill. It certainly was a large task, and they did a superb job. So thank you to all those involved. And with that, whenever you are ready, Chair Pryor.
All right. And I think the best way to start this is just to walk through the DE amendment as it stands right now and to turn that over to the person best qualified to do that. Mr. Chair, if we could turn the next part of the presentation over to Ms. Pera.
Thank you. And Ms. Pera, if you would take it from the top.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll be walking through the DE1, and there's a summary in your packets. One thing to note before I start the walkthrough is that for each section that doesn't have an explicit effective date, because it's in a bill without an appropriation, the default effective date would be August 1, 2023. Article 1 is the general education article. Section 1 requires a district to publish a summary of the commissioner's review and comment of a construction project at least 48 days before a referendum for bonds or solicitation of bids. Section 2 allows the board of a school district and a non-public school to mutually agree to a written plan for transportation of non-public school students. Section 3 modifies the reporting requirement relating to basic skills revenue. It eliminates the requirement that districts report expenditures incurred to meet the needs of eligible children and replaces it with a commissioner report to the legislature on district expenditures. Section 4 strikes the limit on the first term of the school trust lands director. Section 5 modifies the duties of the school trust lands director and allows the director to employ staff in the classified service. And Section 6 modifies the appeal process for denial of the commissioner's certification that a vendor's products and services qualify for the education tax credit. Article 2 is the education excellence article. Section 1 requires education records transmitted to other districts or educational entities to include pupil withdrawals and the services a pupil needs to prevent inappropriate behavior from recurring. Section 2 modifies the requirements for a person providing homeschool instruction. Section 3 requires a school district or charter school to pay all employees their full wages and benefits for scheduled work hours during an e-learning period, and to allow employees to work from home to the extent practicable, be assigned to work in an alternative location, or be retained on call for a potential need. Section 4 modifies the definition of required standard for purposes of the state academic standards and requires districts to adopt state arts standards that'll appear in a couple of spots. Section 5 requires the state high school math standards to include Algebra 2, Integrated Math 3 or an equivalent, and for the 8th grade standards to include completion of algebra. It requires districts to adopt the state arts standards and adds media arts to the 5th arts area. It also modifies the physical education standards requirements. Section 6 strikes a prohibition on the Department of Education amending or repealing academic standards without specific legislative authorization. Section 7 requires local career and technical education standards to align with CTE frameworks developed by the department, standards developed by national CTE organizations, or recognized industry standards. Section 8 modifies the math and social studies credit requirements for graduation, which require students to complete a course for credit in government and citizenship to complete sufficient credits to satisfy the state physical education standards. Section 9 modifies references to the agricultural education or business education programs. Section 10 defines ethnic studies. Sections 11, 12, and 13 amend the world's best workforce. Section 11 defines terms. Section 12 modifies the world's best workforce plan requirements, including requiring a plan to include a process to assess ethnic studies needs, assess access to ethnic studies curriculum using culturally responsive methodologies, and certain other elements. Section 13 requires a district advisory committee to recommend strategies to ensure the curriculum is rigorous, accurate, anti-racist, and culturally sustaining, and strategies regarding the learning and work environments. Section 14 modifies the gifted and talented student program statute by adding services. Section 15 replaces the average daily attendance with consistent attendance in the state reporting system, and replaces reference to the American College Test with the ACT. Section 16, this amends the statewide testing statute and strikes definitions relating to adaptive assessments and above grade and below grade test items. Section 17 requires district to publish the testing calendar at least 1 week before eligible assessments are administered, no later than October 1. Section 18 modifies how growth is measured on the state assessments, the MCAs. It requires the commissioner to implement an appropriate growth model comparing test scores over time and include progress toward English language proficiency in a growth model. Section 19 strikes reference to setting growth targets. Section 20 requires the commissioner to, this is in the school bullying policy statute, and requires the commissioner to develop and maintain resources to assist a district or school in implementing strategies for creating a positive school climate and use evidence-based social-emotional learning to prevent and reduce discrimination and other improper conduct. Section 21 defines malicious and sadistic conduct and requires school boards to prohibit malicious and sadistic conduct involving certain protected grounds by district or school staff member or student against another staff member or student. Section 22 defines non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices. Section 23 defines people withdrawal agreement. Section 24 prohibits dismissals for students in kindergarten through third grade unless non-exclusionary discipline has been exhausted and there's an ongoing serious safety threat to the child or others. Section 25 requires a school to use non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices before dismissal proceedings or pupil withdrawal agreements, except in certain circumstances. Section 26 requires alternative education services be provided to a pupil who's suspended for more than 5 consecutive school days. Section 27 requires school administration to allow a suspended pupil the opportunities to complete schoolwork assigned during the suspension and receive full credit for completing the assignments, and encourages a school principal to designate a liaison to work with the pupil's teachers. Section 28 requires the written notice of intent to expel or exclude a student to describe the non-exclusionary discipline used to try to avoid the expulsion proceedings. Section 29 requires a readmission plan to include measures to improve the pupil's behavior and require parental involvement in the readmission process. It also has certain elements that are optional in that plan, and it states the suspension doesn't apply if it's less than one school day. Section 30 requires a school board to report pupil withdrawal agreements and non-exclusionary discipline used in response to an assault. Section 31 requires a school board to establish non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices. It has requirements relating to expulsions and exclusions, relating to student being on track for readmission, eligibility for school-based mental health services, and accessing mental health services. Section 32 is the corporal punishment statute. This section defines prone restraint. It prohibits an employee or agent of the district from using a prone restraint, and it prohibits using a physical hold that restricts a pupil's ability to breathe or communicate distress, place pressure on certain body parts, or results in straddling a pupil's torso. Section 33 requires a district's discipline policy to have a discipline complaint procedure that somebody can, in the school community, can use to file a complaint about the application of discipline policies and seek corrective action. Section 34 requires district's discipline policy to have certain elements, including procedures to ensure the victims of bullying who respond with prohibited behavior have access to remedial response. Section 35 requires a school board to support school staff in using tiered interventions to address student behavior. And strongly encourages the school board to adopt policies regarding staff responses to student behavior. Section 36 requires the discipline policy to contain procedures to file a complaint when the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act and other statutory discipline requirements are not implemented appropriately or are being discriminately applied, and establishes the requirements of the complaint procedure. Section 37 defines recess detention and encourages districts and charter schools to ensure student access to structured breaks, limits the use of recess detention, requires districts and charter schools to compile information on recess detention, and prohibits withholding or excessively delaying a student's participation in scheduled mealtimes. Those are the discipline sections. Turning now to Section 38, which is open enrollment. So Section 38 allows a district to require a student who's a non-resident and is in an early childhood special education program or another preschool program to follow the regular enrollment procedures to go into kindergarten, except that a student who is in voluntary pre-kindergarten program or a school readiness plus program, those students would be automatically enrolled in kindergarten in the district. Section 39 shortens the time period for a parent to notify the non-resident district when a student intends to enroll in a non-resident district. The next few sections amend the Post-Secondary Enrollment Options Act, so PSEO. Section 40 prohibits a post-secondary institution participating in PSEO from requiring a faith statement during the application process or basing an admission decision on the student's race, creed, ethnicity, disability, gender, or sexual orientation or religious beliefs or affiliations. Section 41 requires a post-secondary institution to notify the student's school as soon as practicable if the student withdraws from a course or stops attending. Section 42 requires a secondary pupil enrolled in a PSEO course to provide the high school with the pupil's interim or non-final grades earned during the academic term. Section 43 shortens the time period for a student to withdraw or be absent from a PSEO course, which is what triggers the department to stop payments to the post-secondary institution. Section 44, currently in statute, there is an Online Learning Options Act, which passed around 2003. That is, in a later section, that is repealed, and it's replaced with this new Section 44, which it defines terms like blended instruction, online instruction, and it regulates how districts provide online instruction to enrolled students, as well as supplemental courses offered to students that are not enrolled in the district. Section 45 strikes language allowing a student to participate in a learning year program and accelerate attainment of grade level requirements or graduation requirements. Section 46 modifies what's called SLIFE, which are students with limited or interrupted formal education. Section 47 raises to 17 the minimum age of participation in an adult basic education program. Section 48 requires the plan to address, this is amending the achievement and integration statute, so this requires an achievement and integration plan to address institutional racism in schools that create opportunity and achievement gaps, requires the district to use local data to develop plan components and strategies. There's a list of optional plan elements, some of which are recodified and then some are added to that list. Section 49 modifies the commissioner's response to a district that has not met its goals under an achievement and integration plan. Section 50 amends PELRA, which is the Public Sector Labor Relations Act, modifies the definition of public employee, allowing a temporary or seasonal school district or charter school employee to be counted as a public employee for purposes of collective bargaining. Section 51 is an instruction to the revisor to renumber statutes in Chapter 120B. And Section 52 is the repealer. It repeals a section relating to graduation rates for students with emotional or behavioral disorders and the Online Learning Option Act. Article 3 is the American Indian Education Article. Section 1 amends the data practices, part of the Data Practices Act, and it allows private educational data to be disclosed to tribal nations about tribally enrolled or descendant students. Section 2 replaces Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day on the list of holidays that a school district may conduct school. It requires at least 1 hour of the school program that day to be devoted to observance of the day and lists topics that the district might include for instruction that day. Section 3 amends the academic standards statute, adding there's a list of stakeholders that the commissioner has to consult when developing standards, and this adds the Tribal Nations Education Committee and Minnesota's Tribal Nations and Communities. Section 4, continuing with academic standards, requires the commissioner to embed Indigenous education for all students, consistent with recommendations from Minnesota's tribal nations and urban Indigenous community into the state's academic standards. Delays review of the physical education standards to the 26-27 school year and requires the commissioner to embed ethnic studies into state academic standards. Section 5 requires the commissioner to provide districts resources to support implementation of Indigenous education for all students and conduct a needs assessment to inform the development of future resources for Indigenous education for all students. Section 6 prohibits this public school from having an American Indian mascot, nickname, logo, letterhead, or team names, and there is an exemption process set out in the section. Section 7 defines American Indian student. Section 8 limits American Indian education programs to programs to support American Indian students. Section 9 limits participation of children enrolled in non-public schools who enroll on a shared time basis in American Indian education programs to American Indian children. Section 10 modifies where American Indian education programs must be located. Section 11 requires districts or participating schools to conduct American Indian education programs if they meet certain thresholds for the number or percent of students that are American Indian. Section 12 requires dedicated American Indian education program coordinators and strikes references to community coordinator or homeschool liaisons. Section 13 modifies the requirements relating to American Indian parent advisory committees and requires the state count of American Indian students to be used for purposes of the American Indian Education Act. Section 14 requires the commissioner to provide technical assistance to districts, schools, and post-secondary institutions on the annual report of American Indian student data using the student count. Section 15 modifies the duties of the American Indian Education Director. Section 16 prohibits a district or charter school from prohibiting, so in other words, it allows an American Indian student to wear American Indian regalia, tribal regalia, or objects of cultural significance at a graduation ceremony. Section 17 requires the state count of American Indian students to be used to determine eligibility for Indian education aid. Section 18 strikes a reference to pilot programs in the American Indian Education Program statute. And Section 19 allows an American Indian student to carry a medicine pouch containing loose tobacco intended as observance of traditional spiritual or cultural practices. Article 4 is the teacher's article. Section 1 modifies the e-learning statute, and it requires the school board to meet and negotiate with the exclusive representative of teachers before adopting an e-learning day plan. Section 2 requires the school board to adopt a written policy that prohibits discrimination or discipline for a teacher or principal for incorporating into curriculum contributions by persons in the protected class. Section 3 requires a teacher to hold a field license or permission aligned to the content area and scope of the teacher's assignment to provide instruction in a public school, including a charter school. The next set of sections is definitions that are used in Chapter 122A relating to licensure. So Section 4 expands the sections that the definitions in 122A06 apply to. Section 5 modifies the definition of teacher. Section 6 is the definition of field. Section 7 modifies definition of shortage area and how it's determined. Section 7 strikes examples of teacher preparation programs. Section 9 adds examples of teacher preparation program providers. Section 10 defines a district as a school district or charter school. Section 11 defines a transfer pathway. Section 12 strikes obsolete language regarding the Pelsby offices. Section 13 requires Pelsby to approve teacher preparation providers. Section next three sections relate to Pelsby's duties. So Section 14 modifies the register of licensed teacher that Pelsby maintains. Section 15 adds sections, so a list of sections for which Pelsby issues rules. And Section 16 expands the types of teacher preparation programs Pelsby must encourage to develop alternative pathways for licensing teachers. Section 17 modifies the Pelsby report on teacher preparation providers. Section 18 modifies the Pelsby report to the legislature regarding teacher candidates. Section 19 modifies the section to which the definition of teacher for purposes of licensure applies. There's also a number of technical changes, changing candidate to applicant, so this is one of them in Section 20. Section 21 corrects a statutory reference relating to support personnel qualifications. Section 22 limits the licensure via portfolio process to initial Tier 3 licenses or to add a licensure field to a Tier 3 or 4 license. Section 23 requires Pelsby to collect data on educators' employment and assignments from all districts and charter schools and allows the report to include data on educators' demographics and licensure. Section 24 amends the Tier 1 teacher license. It requires the application to be submitted jointly by the applicant and district. Section 25 is a technical change. Section 26 expands the list of applicants that are exempt from the requirement to hold a bachelor's degree for a Tier 1 license to include persons teaching world languages and culture and the performing or visual arts. Section 27 strikes a provision that allows Pelsby to submit written comments to a district or charter school that requests a Tier 1 license renewal. Section 28 allows Pelsby to review applications for a Tier 1 license before July 1, and it removes the 30-day deadline for issuing or denying the license. Section 29 allows a Tier 1 teacher to be part of the teacher bargaining unit. Section 30 requires applications for a Tier 2 license to be submitted jointly by the applicant and district. Section 31 is a technical change. Section 32, similar to the one for to the change for Tier 1, it expands the list of applicants that are exempt from the requirement to hold a bachelor's degree for a Tier 2 license to include persons teaching world languages and culture, performing or visual arts. Section 33, again, similar to the Tier 1 change, allows Pelsby to begin reviewing applications earlier. Section 34 modifies the Tier 3 license requirements. It strikes a provision that allows the candidate to obtain a Tier 3 without a bachelor's degree because that's recodified later in Section 35. It requires Pelsby to issue a Tier 3 license to a candidate who either completed a teacher preparation program from a culturally specific minority-serving institution and who's eligible for a teacher license in another state, or who completed a teacher preparation program in another country and has taught at least 2 years, as long as the candidate's completed student teaching comparable to Minnesota requirements. Section 35, this is where that the list of applicants who don't need a bachelor's for a Tier 3 is expanded to include the world languages and culture and performing or visual arts teachers. Section 36 amends the Tier 4 license. It requires an applicant to have field-specific teaching experience from any state rather than only Minnesota, and to complete Tier 3 renewal requirements if the applicant previously had a Tier 3 license. It strikes the part that requires the candidate to have their most recent summative evaluation not place the candidate on an improvement process. Section 37 amends the teacher licensure testing requirements. It eliminates the skills exam in reading, writing, and math. Currently, that's just for Tier 4. This eliminates it entirely. The pedagogy and content exams would be eliminated for an applicant that's completed a Pelsby-approved preparation program or a state-approved teacher preparation program in another state and who passed licensure exams in that state. And it eliminates the reading instruction test for Tier 3 and 4 licenses to teach elementary students. It requires Pelsby to adopt rules requiring performance assessments as alternatives to examinations for pedagogy and content, and it modifies requirements for testing centers. It requires the vendor to waive test fees for some test takers, provide free and practice tests and study guides, and make other accommodations. Section 38, it strikes the requirement that Pelsby-approved programs provide students remedial assistance if they don't pass the skills exam. Section 39 strikes the requirement that Pelsby require satisfactory evidence of teaching or administrative experience to renew a license, and also strikes the requirement relating to a coach license, athletic coach license. Section 40 expands the organizations that can have teacher preparation programs. Section 41 allows adult basic education and early childhood family education teachers to obtain tenure or continuing contract. Sections 42 and 44 make the same changes. One of these is for the cities of the district and cities of the first class, and the other is districts outside the first class. And both reduce from 120 to 60 the number of days of teaching service that a probationary teacher has to complete during the probationary period in each year. It also modifies the probationary teacher for a teacher who's taught for 3 consecutive years in a single district or charter school in Minnesota or another state So that teacher would only need to have a one-year probationary period in that second district or school. Section 43 and 45 are the same. Again, one is for districts in the city of first class and one outside. And that requires a teacher evaluation process to include a rubric of performance standards for teacher practice that is based on professional teaching standards established in rule, includes culturally responsive methodologies, and provides common descriptions of effectiveness using at least three levels of performance. And that's effective July 1, 2025. Section 46 establishes a short call substitute teacher pilot program for the 2023-24 and 2024-25 school years, allowing a district or charter school and an applicant to jointly request that Pelsby approve an application for a short call substitute license, as long as the applicant meets specific requirements. Pelsby would be able to issue the license pending a background check, and could immediately suspend or revoke the license upon receiving the background check. And it sets a minimum rate of pay for substitute teachers in the pilot program. Section 47 strikes the requirement that student teachers have completed at least 2 years of an approved teacher program preparation program to have classroom experience. Section 48 modifies the principal's annual evaluation process to include principal's culturally responsive leadership practices and to be linked to professional development that emphasizes culturally responsive leadership practices. Section 45 modifies the definition of teacher for purposes of PELRA, the collective bargaining statute, which determines what individuals can be in the teacher bargaining unit. Currently, teachers have to be licensed in order to be in that bargaining unit. This would include in the unit teachers that are not licensed but that are creating and delivering instruction to children in a pre-kindergarten or early learning program. Those teachers would be allowed to stay in a different non-teacher bargaining unit that is certified before January 1, 2023, with some exceptions. Section 50 also amends the Labor Relations Act, the public sector one, by requiring collective bargaining for school employees to include class sizes, student testing, and student-to-personnel ratios. Section 51 is a revisor instruction, instructing the revisor to substitute the term applicant or applicants for candidate or candidates in specified sections. Section 52 is a repealer. It repeals a section with some obsolete language on first appointments to Pelsby, school district reports to Pelsby and BOSA, another Pelsby report, a temporary military license, and two rules, or one rule, two subparts relating to teacher licensure exams. Article 5 is the charter school article. Section 1 defines market need and demand study, and that's referenced in several of the other sections in the article. Section 2 requires a charter school to comply with the statute on alternatives to pupil suspension. Section 3 requires a charter school to comply with the Education for English Learners Act. Section 4 modifies a provision relating to the length of an authorizer's term. Section 5 modifies a cross-reference, providing a reason for an authorizer withdrawal. Section 6 requires a charter school developer's application to include a market need and demand study, and it eliminates the requirement for a statement of assurances of legal compliance. Section 7 requires an authorizer's affidavit stating the intent to charter school to include a market need and demand study. Section 8 requires an authorizer to submit a market need and demand study when a school that the authorizer charters wants to add grades or sites. Section 9 clarifies that a charter contract between a charter school board and an authorizer must include a statement of the school's admissions policies and procedures. Section 10 makes several changes relating to admissions to a charter school. First, it requires that admission to the charter school be free to Minnesota pupils and requires enrollment preference for Minnesota residents. It also eliminates enrollment preference for children enrolled in a fee-based preschool or pre-kindergarten program to enroll the following year. It also modifies admissions preferences for charter schools that serve at least 90% of enrolled students who are eligible for special education services and have a primary disability of deaf, hard of hearing, or deaf-blind. Section 11 requires a charter school, excluding a preschool or pre-K program, to employ a contract with a licensed teacher. And it establishes qualifications for a charter school's pre-kindergarten or preschool program teachers. Section 12 requires a charter school to lease a building from its owner rather than subleasing space. Section 13 limits an affiliated nonprofit building corporation, often called an ABC, to serve only one charter school. And Section 14 strikes an obsolete reference to Chapter 308A, which is cooperatives. Article 6 is special education. Section 1 establishes additional requirements relating to a school's use of restrictive procedures with students with disabilities, including review of disproportionate use of the procedures and the role of school resource officers. It also prohibits the use of seclusion on children from birth through pre-kindergarten and modifies reporting requirements. Section 2 provides that a parent of a student with a disability who is not yet enrolled in kindergarten and not open enrolled in a non-resident district can have the non-resident district where the child is going to a Head Start program or licensed child care program to get special education services. The child can be served in that same setting as other children in the non-resident district with the same level of disability. Sections 3, 4, and 5 make similar changes. These statutes relate to children placed in day or residential care and treatment programs. It allows the district or charter school that provides an educational program to use an online learning program if the parent agrees. Article 7 is the nutrition and libraries article. Section 1 modifies requirements relating to the Federal Summer Food Service Program. Requires the department to evaluate financial eligibility as part of the application process and specifies documentation that an applicant must submit. Section 2 prohibits a participant in the school lunch program from providing students alternative meals not specifically related to dietary needs or providing non-reimbursable meals. Section 3 limits this relates to the CACFP program, which is the Child and Adult Care Food Program, as well as the Summer Food Service Program. It limits how often legally distinct CACFP and SFSP sites can transfer sponsoring organizations. It requires a non-governmental organization applying to sponsor a site to provide documentation that staff members have completed specific training. And it prohibits the department from approving a new SFSP site within a half-mile radius of an existing site unless a new program would serve a different group of children or if there are safety issues relating to that would be a barrier to participation. Section 4 establishes requirements for a school library or school media center. Section 5 replaces a reference to citizen with resident. Section 6 makes a technical change. Section 7 updates a reference to Spanish-speaking with multilingual learners. Section 8 states that regional library basic system support aid is subject to reduced maintenance of effort requirements. And Section 9 is our advisor instruction to replace terms like free lunch or free meals. Terms like free lunch with free meals when they appear in statute in the context of the National School Lunch and Breakfast Program. That is the summary, Mr. Chair.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ms. Farah. And members, now with that, we will open it up to the table here for clarifying questions on the DE amendment. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Ryer. Thank you for including my little bit on civics education in the bill. But I had a question, and I can go either way on this, but I believe I had an amendment to add 10th grade in with the 11th and 12th graders, and that's not included in here. Is that by oversight or intent? Again, I have no strong feeling on that, but wondered what your intent was.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Erdahl, for the question and for the discussion that will open up. It was, I think that it reflects kind of what discussion was and feedback that the committee received in terms of right now what's going on in schools and how civics and government are being taught, and that sometimes it is in the ninth grade, and that they build on that. And I think we ended up with the opinion that what was important to accomplish by focusing on and requiring civics to be taught as part of before you graduate, that we could still include that and that importance by including the ninth grade going forward, and to include that grade, I think, is where we ended up right now, instead of starting in 10th grade. But, you know, this is a process, and, you know, this is the kind of, as an example of civics and government and how things get debated, and the wisdom of the elected officials can prevail. It could be that, you know, it's not, this is not the end of the process and not the end of the discussion.
Representative, Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And yeah, you know, I didn't have strong feelings on 10th graders. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, there's a suggestion to do it, so I did it. But if you want to do 11th and 12th, I'm fine with that too.
I guess we do have to look to make sure it was written. I think we wanted to include that starting at ninth grade, and it could be that there was an oversight that we didn't get the final wording that we wanted in that, and that would be why we have these kinds of discussions. And that's why we introduced the bill now to make sure that it goes forward in the way. Because I actually, the intent was to actually add the ninth grade instead of starting in the 10th grade. And that's another discussion.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Erdahl.
And I don't know.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And we'll have this discussion more deeply. It is, I believe, important. I mean, look, civics, we have it in our standards from kindergarten. I mean, various components of it. The strong belief that I and many others have is that in Minnesota, it's mostly taught in ninth grade. It is too young. These students are not ready to learn, as evidenced by the proficiency rate at graduation. So the purpose of what I've been trying to do are twofold. One, and I appreciate you addressing these, one is that civics be a credit-bearing course, making more relevant. I don't assign, you know, in this how many, just credit. It's up to the school district. And the other is that it be taught to juniors and seniors, because these are people who are about ready. They're getting their driver's licenses, they're registering to vote, and all of those things. They're ready to take that next step, and ninth graders are not. I'm not saying don't teach in ninth grade. They can still teach in ninth grade, but that credit-bearing course should be to juniors or seniors.
Representative Pryor, response?
For further consideration. Thank you, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the members here? Chair, Representative Uekeen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Pryor, I had a question on some online learning stuff, but I think the testifiers from MDE, if they might be covering it, so I can wait.
Okay. Definitely have some resources available for specific questions on.
Okay, then I'll wait. Thanks.
I mean, right now we do. If you want to ask, yes, we have.
Yeah, so Article 2, Section 44, Subdivision 4, it's on the rigor around online coursework, mm-hmm. and who gets to decide what that rigor is. And I know I've talked to the department about this before, because I had a constituent very concerned about online Spanish classes. So it looks like the district is able to decide whether or not the rigor is good enough. Maybe just some clarification what the language in Article 2, Section 44, Subdivision 4 is.
Thank you, Representative Yuen-Keen. Representative Pryor.
Mr. Chair, I would like to call on the resources that we have available in the room for a comment on this particular question.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Yuen-Keen. If you would introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Adosh Uni for the record, Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. And just to repeat the question to make sure I got it right, Chair Yuen-Keen, you're referring to Article 2, Section 44 and how we would determine the rigor in online course instruction. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Uni, and maybe just describing a little bit, because I'm seeing there's a lot of new language of what we're changing specifically around what an enrolling district can do if a student's going to be taking an online class. I know I've had conversations with worried about the rigor of what that, and it says like submit a syllabus, but just maybe walk me through really quickly what can be done if a district feels like the rigor is not is not strong enough to actually allow for a credit for graduation.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Hooney?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Chair Yuen-Keen, so the overarching purpose of the moving to online learning as away from an approval process to a continuous improvement process is we've learned even before the pandemic that districts and charters have been moving into the capability of offering online instruction as a learning modality, that they have built up the expertise to be able to deliver the content to meet the academic standards through the curriculum that they're choosing at the local level, and they need to meet the same academic rigor that they are expected to deliver in an in-person setting. One of the things that we are trying to move into as well, away from allocating our resources towards an approval process, is using our staff time and our resources towards continuous improvement and providing technical assistance and guidance for our districts and being able to deliver their content in a high-quality fashion through the online modality. And so if a district does have challenges or presented challenges with delivering their online instruction, I think how you presented it, does it mean the rigor of being able to deliver the academic standards for students to meet the graduation requirements? We would be able to provide that technical assistance to them with our online learning specialist teams for one-on-one help. We'd also be providing guidance through our seminars, through professional development, through various modes there.
Follow-up, Representative Yuen-Keen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I need to be more specific. I was not asking the question very well. My concern is with other online providers besides the school district, and because you have in here that a district can't prevent a student from taking online courses if that district feels like the rigor that other provider is giving is not doesn't qualify for meeting the standards or should not be used for a graduation requirement, what recourse do they have then if the MDE is not the one having the umbrella over the approval of that online rigor?
Ms. Rooney.
So if I understand correctly, if a student is taking a supplemental online course not from their district in which they are enrolled, whether they are open enrolled or they're a resident student, so they'd be taking it through a supplemental online provider, and that is the other component that we are retaining the approval process for in this whole scheme. So Madam Chair and Mr. Chair for the opportunity to clarify. So in our rewrite of the online learning statute, we're creating two pathways, one for all districts and charters to provide online instruction to their enrolled students, whether they be open enrolled or resident students who are enrolled by virtue of being residents of that district. They do not need to seek approval from the Minnesota Department of Education, and we move into a continuous improvement, guidance, technical assistance relationship with these districts and charters. Supplemental online learning providers are districts or charters that provide online instruction to students who are not enrolled, whether it be open enrolled or resident students to them. Those providers do have to go through an approval process with the department still. And through that process, we would be able to provide more oversight around the rigor that through which the instruction is delivered.
Thank you. And we would ask that additional conversations, please step into the hallway, if you would. Another follow-up, Representative Youakim.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think I understand, and I'm grateful that you're still looking at the other online providers and that you're giving our districts flexibility. But if there's a student that it wants to take Spanish 6 and the district has a hard time finding a Spanish 6 teacher, and they want to take a class in another online provider, and in this language, I mean, can a district say, no, that we don't think that provider provides enough rigor? Or can they not? And what would that process look like? So if it's just like one course versus the district doing it or an online provider doing it. So that's where I'm getting that. Just wondering how that connects.
Thank you,
Representative. And we can talk offline if you want.
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, I want to make sure that I'm not getting you inaccurate information. I know it's a nuance that I want to make sure I'm capturing correctly in that phase where if a student comes, where I've taken an online course, does this meet the graduation requirements? What's the analysis that the district or charter can go through to say, yes, this meets the academic rigor that we expect, and maybe it's not necessarily through a supplemental online learning provider that's been approved by the Department of Education. I'd like to check with our online learning team, Perfect. Specialist team, to make sure I get you accurate information.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions from the members? We'll give one last call here for questions. Okay. And with that, I want to turn it back to a Representative Pryor for any closing comments and then a few announcements as we move towards conclusion.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for taking this away and using it as our start point for the discussion. And I do want to begin by, of course, asking and thanking the staff that actually did the work to put this together. We all know that, we've heard many bills that came forward, and that beginning with the governor's bill and the bill from our Pelsby organization, our teaching licensing board, as well as member bills. And that somehow you have to put all of this language together in a way that flows and makes sense in statute what our intent is. And it's a lot of work, and we have incredible staff that has done that work and really kept track of what we as legislators try to do every year. We are very, very grateful for the quality and commitment of the people that we have as part of this process, and just as a just another acknowledgement of how much we value and appreciate what's done. And that's our nonpartisan staff, but also our partisan staff too that has been a part of it. And some of us were kind of new to this process trying to keep up with everything that's done. So I would also like to acknowledge our partisan staff, including our partisan researchers that we depend on them too, and we always have. So thank you. And people know, who you are and how much we appreciate you and how valued you have been and will continue to be. And that's the next part of my statement right now is that this is a process, and we have been on a pretty good clip from the beginning of this committee to where we are now, and we will continue to be on a good clip. This is the start of what we really consider maybe the policy part of what will be an education bill. There's many components of this that we referred on to education finance because integral to those bills and to those initiatives is the financing part of that. And so we want to continue some of the discussions that is that combination of finance and policy together as we move forward in this process. So just to know that this is not all the policy that's going to be produced in this session, in this legislative body, but that there'll be more of those the bills that we've moved on are still live and still under consideration, but this is the policy of work that we laid over in this committee, and that now together we are bringing this together and moving on this bill to our Education Finance Committee. And I will take a question.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Representative Earl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Pryor, thank you for your work on this. I just want clarification. Is there going to be one policy bill, one finance bill, or will there be one combined bill?
Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let me say at this point that we're not there yet where we know exactly what's going to come off the House floor, and we're working with another body, we're looking with lots of parts. But what I can say right now is that our intent is on Friday to move this bill to Education Finance.
Thank you, Representative. With that, I'd also like to offer a message of thanks to all of our staff colleagues and to the members of the committee, those who are advocating for positions and continuing the conversations. We thank you all for the role and the part you played. And with that, any last closing comments, Representative Pryor?
Thank you.
With that, this meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.